I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Real Spoilers, powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real Spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 267, Beauty and the Beast. Which are you, Kevin?
You know what? I'm going to let the listeners decide because, you know, the podcast medium is a great way to determine whether one is beauty or a beast.
You know, like it's very new millennium where it's so now the joke everybody's sick of hearing is I have a face for podcasting.
That's yeah, where we're at. Exactly.
We're down to two on this particular episode. So we brought in a guest, our resident Disney expert, Jim Hill from Jim Hill Media. Hi, Jim.
Hey, guys. How are you tonight?
Doing excellent. So we figured who would know more about this sort of stuff than Jim Hill? He always has great inside scoop and stories and behind the scenes and trivia. And like, there's a lot of Disney nerds on this podcast, but you kick our ass, and we mean that as a compliment, even though it had the word nerd in it.
All right.
So I guess let's just kind of start. We normally just kind of go through the plot points of the movie, and since Joe, our resident synopsisizer, is not here, I'm going to make Kevin do it.
Oh no! Really?
Yeah, you're the one that's like, I love this, but I've seen the original million times, so it should be easy for you.
First of all, it was only 900,000 times I've seen the original. To be fair, but no, this is my favorite Disney animated film. This is one that I've held near and dear for a long time growing up. You know, I think I rank it somewhere. I mean, this number one, Aladdin number two, Lion King number three. So that's kind of my order. Tom, what's your order of Disney animated stuff?
Especially when you get into that, the Disney
Renaissance, not the old, but including of like Mermaid or Great Mouse Detective on.
I got to go with Little Mermaid.
Yeah,
I think every song in that works. Like, there's not a clunker among them in that one.
See, that's how I feel about this one, too, because the music is so good, and obviously we'll get into that, but I think the reason it's so timeless is because the animated film, the Broadway show, this movie, you know, without this great music, you know, I mean, that's what really makes it. Jim, how about you? What are some of your favorites from the resurgence?
Well, you know, I mean, it just... You know, the Beast is a favorite, but if I've got to pick a best from that period, I think it's Aladdin. Mostly because of, you know, I mean, it's a great Venn diagram. I mean, it's you know, great Disney animation, wonderful score, you know, the last that we really got from Ashman, and coupled with, you know, Robin Williams' performance, which, you know, really, you know, sort of set fire to that film. And particularly now that, you know, the way we lost Robin Williams, it's just, it's a harder film to watch now, particularly. You know, I always tear up when the genie says goodbye to Aladdin. I think that's one of the best story moments out of a Disney animated film. But now it's just that much tougher to watch. But sure. Beast is right up there. I mean, Beast is the film that convinced a lot of adults. You know, I mean, that was the thing. People forget about, you know, the film in 91. This was a date movie. I mean, people literally took other adults to this movie because of the romance and the humor and the music. And that was, you know, why it was the very first, you know, animated film to get, you know, to get a Best Picture nomination. And
I feel like this was the movie where people were like, this is Broadway for the masses. Like, this is Broadway without going to Broadway. It was a Broadway caliber production. It just happened to be a cartoon.
And, you know, it's funny you say that, because that when Frank Rich, who was the lead theater critic for the New York Times, wrote about this movie, he said the best Broadway musical of the year is in a movie theater right now. It's Beauty and the Beast. And that is actually one of the things that convinced Michael Eisner that, okay, this is the one we're going to take to Broadway. This is going to be our first, you know, really for real theatrical production. So, right on the money.
That's why it's such a smooth transition. I mean, it works so well, because how do you screw that up? I mean, as long as you have good costumes and good actors, like, the songs are already there. It's a hit Broadway show waiting to be made. So
it was still, I mean, you know, they still struggled with that one. In fact, that there are some just great stories from the tryout at Theater of the Stars. And I want to say it was Houston where, you know, I mean, there's things you could do in animation. Like, for example, Act Two of the musical starts off with a wolf attack on, you know, on Belle in the woods. And, you know, for the initially what they did were puppets. And, you know, so it's supposed to be this big, tense moment. And the music builds and out of the fog basically come these dog Muppets. And it was like, you know, the audience starts laughing. And it's just sort of like, okay, that's not going to work. You know, and to this day, even when, you know, community theater groups do it, because I guess they reconfigure the wolves as dancers, like really bad cats type dancers only with wolf costumes.
That's redundant.
Yeah.
It's one of those moments where it's like, can we get past this quickly and get the Beast back and Belle back to the castle? And
you know, it's interesting. I've never seen the Broadway production, but I've always kind of wondered where the split point is, because I don't feel like this story has a natural, like, traditional Shakespearean apex moment where this is where the story break is, and it ends on a big beat, and then you take a pause, have your intermission, and pick it up. Like, it doesn't really have that moment. Its halfway point is they're kind of just putzing around the castle trying to figure out if they love each other.
To me, it seems like after the wolf attack, when she realizes that she doesn't leave him to die, she saves him.
Yeah.
And after that, you get the There's Something There song. So to me, that feels like the split.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, in fact, what's kind of funny is the difference between the Broadway show and now the 2017 live action is that in the 2017 thing, you have the number when the Beast releases Belle and she goes back to where, you know, hops on the horse and goes running, you know, off into the countryside. There's a song. What is it? Forevermore, I think. The Beast.
Evermore.
Yeah.
Yeah, that new one by Dan Stevens, or that he sings, is Evermore.
Yeah, and it's just the thing is he's climbing the castle and he keeps looking at the window and she's getting further away and, you know, because she's riding on her, you know, wearing her yellow dress so he can pick her out in the ornamental garden. But in the Broadway show, the way they end Act One is that, you know, from the moment where the bell jar, where she, you know, she goes to touch the rose, takes the bell jar off, and he screams at her and that sort of thing, and he realizes he's driven her away, and it's the exact same thing. He basically climbs the castle. They actually rotate the set. And he has a song called If I Can't Love Her. And it's actually the big ballad that ends the first act. And it's what's really effective with that placement. To be honest, I don't think, you know, Forevermore worked where it was in the live action thing. I mean, I get it. You know, you want to give Dan Stevens a song, and obviously this is a dramatic point in the story, but it's just sort of like he kept singing and climbing and singing and climbing. And it's just sort of like, all right, you're going to run out of castle soon, because this really isn't a good song. You know,
it's like, is this castle designed by Eicher?
See, I'll have to agree to disagree with you there, because that's my favorite new song of the movie. I loved it. I thought it was just beautifully written by Alan Menken. I thought Dan Stevens did a great job performing it. Josh Groban does a version, but I actually prefer the Dan Stevens one, and I loved it.
Well, I think Jim and I are going to gang up on you then, because I thought all the new music for this movie was just completely bland and forgettable.
Yeah, so I wasn't too crazy about most of the additions. There's four new songs. Mm-hmm. If you include the post-credits version that Celine Dion sings, that Kevin Kline kind of hums a few bars of it, you know. But I just thought Evermore was beautiful. But, you know, hey, you know, to each their own.
Yeah, I just was really disappointed.
But it's interesting you say that, because I think, you know, Kevin Kline, because he undersells that song, it works.
Oh, yeah. His version, don't get me wrong, his version's better than Celine Dion's. I would much rather hear Kevin, because Kevin Kline is singing it about his daughter and his life, and there's acting going on. It's not just singing. He's acting the song.
It's
funny
how you say that Kevin Kline undersells, because I felt like his entire performance undersold the role. And I mean that in a good way. Like, it would have been so easy to go big, and instead he went the other direction, and I do think that he made his story arc a lot more poignant because he went smaller, not larger. Like, he felt more wounded by life. I totally agree.
So so if we're talking performances and differences in characters, we gotta go to it, gentlemen. Let's talk about LeFou.
And certainly, this to me, I you know, you have some more insight than I do, I think, but I thought it was such a non-issue, because, you know, the director, Bill Condon, did an interview, and I think it was a gay magazine or online publication, and so I think he was pandering to his audience. I mean, he clearly was using dialogue that he doesn't use in his everyday or any other interviews, and he tried to play it up to their audience, like, hey, we have an openly gay character. And I completely disagree. There's nothing openly gay about the character. You can infer it, you can take your best guess. I mean, it clearly is in that direction, but again, he's not openly gay. The definition of that would be him saying, I am gay, I am looking for a husband. Like, he's not,
I don't know,
gay.
I felt like he was pretty open about his attraction to Gaston. It's just Gaston was so narcissistic, he didn't hear it.
But you'd have to interpret that. I mean, the actor, Luke Evans, for instance, he has came out and said that he does not feel that LeFou is gay. He feels that he is looking up to him like a best friend, or, you know, like you would do to another.
That feels like damage control.
Maybe, but, you know, but
guys,
guys,
all right. Yes. We're not talking about gay. We're talking about, we have a LeFou that is at least 20 to 30 IQ points ahead of Gaston. I mean, again, I think that was the story. The smart LeFou, LeFou defuse situations where, like, for example, when he calms down Gaston at some point, remember the war, widows, you know, I mean, just, I think for me, that was what was fascinating, the notion of the smart LeFou, the one who's, you know, in fact, I think as the film is starting, he's actually questioning whether I should be still hanging out with this guy. I mean, in fact, supposedly, according to Condon, there was this entire backstory that they worked out for Gaston that basically 12 years before the film starts, there's this battle, and Gaston actually manages to defeat this group of Portuguese marauders that are invading the village. And so he's been a hero and revered for this time, but he's been riding on that this whole time. And, you know, LeFou was with him in the wars and clearly was enamored of him at that point. But again, over the course of the way he behaves in this movie, you kind of see LeFou disengaging. In fact, there's that moment in the middle of the slapstick battle at the castle where suddenly, you know, what is it? LeFou is talking with Mrs. Potts, and again, we're kind of in a bad place. And, you know, I really feel like I need to switch sides. And I don't know. I mean,
that actually starts in the Kill the Beast song. You know, that was, I thought, one of the best additions. You know, I know we're jumping around a bit, but in that song, Kill the Beast, a completely new line for LeFou says that, you know, there's a beast running about. I can't remember the lines, but it's not the beast. Right. It's Gaston is what he's alluding to.
Yeah.
And I thought that was great. That was a great character.
Although I would argue that change in direction for LeFou is proof that they think he's a gay character, because they didn't want to make him a gay character and then have him be a villain, so they had to have a redemption of sorts for him, so they didn't have to deal with the backlash of, why is the gay guy a villain? That's
interesting.
Well, I don't think we're in blowout territory. You know,
well,
I
mean, no, yeah.
It's, you know, something like that. I mean, for me, the entire issue of LeFou being gay was secondary. I mean, for me, the revelation was, he's smart. You know, yeah. And in fact, you know, just that, and I really enjoyed what he brought to the table. I mean, in fact, that was the thing of Gad's performance was, again, just like Klein's, kind of underpitched. I mean, I love that moment where the Bimbettes are sort of, you know, sort of mooning at Gaston, and you know, and LeFou walks past and forget about it, ladies, never going to happen. You know, yeah.
Interesting.
That,
think, yeah,
added to the film. But then you look at things like, you know, don't get me wrong, I love Stanley Tucci, but the whole Cadenza thing, you know, to go that whole route for one gag at the end of the movie where he's, you know, this he turns into a harpsichord, and then in the big slapstick battle, he's shooting his teeth at people, and so you get that one gag at the end where he smiles after being reunited with his wife, you know, Audrey McDonald, and he's toothless. It's like, you go 2 hours just for that gag?
You know. God, I didn't even realize that was what that was supposed to
mean.
Well, yeah,
because he was shooting the white keys at the bad guys.
I didn't even make that connection.
With no teeth.
In fact, I mean, there's a moment before he plays for the you know, Beauty and the Beast in the ballroom where it's, I will play through the dental pain. And it's just sort of like, I don't know.
I was going to say, they built it up a lot earlier. I was going to mention that line. Like, it was a long game to get to the end.
Yeah, you know, just and that's the other thing. There are so many things in this where they attempt to deepen and change it. And I get it. It's 25 years later. And, you know, the Disney formula, as we've seen so far with, you know, these new fairy tale franchise. I mean, if you think about the changes they made to Cinderella, you know, just a couple of years ago, or likewise Jungle Book, to make it the same only different. It's like, what did you think of the whole magical map thing, and then going back to their old, you know, that's Maurice and his wife's old apartment or home or whatever it was? And
I appreciated the backstory. So, I mean, again, being a huge fan of the animated classic, the original movie is less than an hour and a half. And so this movie is over 2 hours. But to me, it never feels too drawn out. To me, you get backstories of the prince. We understand why the prince is the way he is, because I honestly have a lot of questions and have had questions for 25 years as to why did this 10-year-old or 11-year-old kid, why was he alone? And why is he punished for not letting a stranger in the house? He's 11 years old with no parents. Like, you know, so we get more of his backstory. We get Belle's mother, which we never get any backstory about her mother. In this one, you understand why she's lives alone with her father and the pain they went through. And so to me, those additions were really meaningful, and I enjoyed them because I want more from these characters. I love this story. And so, okay, you know,
I get that. I do. But just as a Disney geek, look, there's an attraction right now at Walt Disney World called Enchanted Tales with Belle, where you go to Maurice's cottage. All right. And, you know, again, the Imagineers, who had no idea, I mean, they were putting this together 2011, 2012, that this movie was ever in the works. But as you go into this place, and there are paintings up on the wall of, you know, toddler Belle, little girl Belle with her mom. And it just, I can't help but think that there's, you know, I mean, face it, this movie, and that's the other thing. I think at some point we have to talk about the box office of this thing. We are eight, you know, what is it? They had Wednesday's numbers up. Okay. As of Wednesday, this thing has made $217 million domestic, coupled with, you factor in $244 million overseas. So total worldwide box office 6 days in is, you know, $461 million. This thing will be at $500 million early Friday. Okay.
So it's both Beauty and a Beast.
Well, it's beautiful for Disney,
it's
for
beautiful
sure.
It is, yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, think about it. You know, the Hollywood rule of thumb is that you have to make three times your production costs before you come into a profit. This thing was budgeted $160 million. So literally, this thing is into profit a week into release. I mean, that's amazing. But at the same time, to double back to the attraction, you know, you, so, you know, you, you've told the world now with this new movie that you know Belle's mom died of plague, and so here you are in the house looking at the pictures up on the wall, and wait a minute, this is where she died. Oh, you know, this is where people had plague.
Oh, that's funny. I never made that connection because I was just at Disney. I went last March and last October, and I never went to that one. I heard it was more for kids, and then we had something to run to, so we were in line, then we got out of it, and so I never actually went into the cottage, but that's a really interesting connection you made.
Yeah, so, it's going to be, I'd hate to be the poor cast member who's in there now. You know, it's like, no, she didn't die of plague. No, that's a live-action movie.
Knowing Disney, instead what they're doing is they sold a very nice sponsorship to, hand sanitizer.
Oh, there you go.
Someone's going to go in there and leave one of those old doctor masks in the cottage.
Those creepy pointy nose ones.
Yeah. So why don't we start at the beginning? Because I have, I have some questions, and I know Jim has some additional insight to the very beginning. So sure. The movie starts off very similarly to the animated film. This time you have the Enchantress narrating, but same old story. You know, there's a prince and he's alone at this castle, but instead of just going through the story, they kind of break into this new song, and that's the one by, is it Audrey McDonald?
Yeah, that Audrey McDonald. Though it's worth noting here that, again, you get to see Dan Stevens, though, he's what? You get close-up of the eyes, and he's got makeup on because he's having a party with all of the attractive young women from the kingdom.
He's got the wig and the makeup, and as they did back in the old days.
Yeah, and again, this is that's the other thing that's kind of intriguing about this. The animated film from 91 is sort of generic fairy tale France. They don't necessarily lock in a period of time. This is 1740. I mean, that's where the production design is set. And not only that, this is set in the south of France. In fact, supposedly somewhere around Villeneuve, set about the
easy
time
for
of
you to
Louis
say.
The 15th. So that explains the way people are dressed at the ball, that sort of thing. But for me, what intrigues me is, again, it's like, look, we want you to know right up front we have Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey in this movie. So pay attention. You'll get to see him again.
to me, this first scene, it wasn't so bad the second time because, of course, going into this movie the first time as a fan of the 91 film, I'm looking for all the changes. I'm like, how are they going to do this? Are they going to mess it up? Are they going to do a great job? And so to me, right off the bat, it felt a little self-indulgent because I'm expecting just the backstory of the prince, and then all of a sudden you get this lavish party with the choreography with all the dances and camera movements sweeping in and out of the ballroom, and to me it just felt a little self-indulgent for the sake of being lavish, and so I didn't necessarily need that dance scene to set things up. I don't know what you...
Well, I think they were trying to get you to sympathize with all the staff who'd been kind of accidentally swept up in the punishment for his douchebaggery. And so I get what they were going for. Although I got to say, overall, I liked this movie, but all the new stuff did nothing for me. Every time they went to something new, to me, it was a snooze fest. It really took me out of it. I didn't think that what they added really added a whole lot.
Well, I like the choice. So I like the choice, again, the backstory, developing the backstory of these characters is something I really appreciated. I didn't necessarily need this whole dance scene, but I get what they were doing, and that's fine. And again, the second time, I was expecting it. So
you were
fine.
Dancing.
Yeah, because I was the dance-along version. But one thing that I really appreciated was him being older, because there's always some confusion and a bit of a weird issue surrounding the original film. So in the original, when people do the math, and again, it's all kind of up in the air, but when people do the math, the original prince is 10 or 11 years old. And so you either have, if he's frozen in time, he basically has the mentality of a 10 or 11 year old who's never really developed past that,
Right.
And so the question is he frozen in time or does he grow up? Because obviously it's before this 21st birthday, he has to make someone fall in love. And so, it's always just a weird question of like, well, then why is Chip still a kid? Because if the prince goes from 10 or 11 to 21, how is Chip a 6-year-old? There's really weird time issues
sure.
at play.
I mean, I guess if you really want to delve into it, you could make the argument that cups, like the inanimate objects don't age over time, but an animal would.
Oh, I've that actually is really insightful because I've never heard that theory.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I like how they made him just an adult right off the bat, or a young adult. You know, right. I like that because you're not dealing with then why is a kid pushing away an old lady at 10 or 11? Because honestly, if you're a 10-year-old kid, you know, alone in your castle, do you really expect strangers? Like at this point in time, who knows who's coming to attack you or do whatever? Like he's, yeah. The kid's 10. So Jim, do you have any insight on the original, like what they were trying to do with that beginning?
It's so strange that it actually went down into that open trash pit that I laughingly call a library in the basement and dug out the screenplay that Linda Wolverton wrote, obviously with Howard Ashman's help, for Beauty and the Beast. And I have the draft here from June of 1990. This was when they were actually going to animate the opening of the film, when they didn't run out of time and money and have to do that entire sequence as a series of stained glass windows. I mean, it's very effective, and it you know, sort of telescopes that action and gets you right, you know, to Belle stepping out of her cottage and right into the song Belle. But if you guys, you want to hear it, or?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay, so this is it's noted as the prologue, and it starts off with an ornate storybook opens on an illustration of a beautiful white shining castle that looks down upon a lush green countryside. Once upon a time, there lived a spoiled, self-centered little boy who would one day grow to rule a kingdom. In full animation, we see an 11-year-old child. Who is being dressed and fussed over by a slew of harried servants, but the boy is making it impossible for them. He's sick and tired of getting all dressed up, sick and tired of being polite, sick and tired of boring old ceremonies. His two regents try to explain that a wise woman respected throughout the land is coming to pay him a visit. The wise woman used to give advice to his parents, and some say she has magical powers. I don't care. It's my castle, and I'm only going to do what I want to. The boy pushes the servants away. Just try and stop me. The boy runs through the courtyard where he collides with what looks like an old beggar woman. She's coming up the walkway carrying a basket of flowers. He knocks her to the ground. The courtiers gasp. Servants run up to help her to her feet. The old woman levels her gaze at the boy. She's a craggy old crone, but with the wisdom of the ages in her eyes. I'm waiting for an apology, she says. The boy seems surprised. He laughs. You can wait all day. You're not going to apologize? He crosses his arms stubbornly. I don't have to. She smiles patiently. I'll give you one more chance. The boy's temper flares. Why should I say I'm sorry to some old beggar woman? I don't care about you. He angrily kicks her basket, scattering flowers in the dirt. Fierce power emanates from her eyes as the wise woman gazes deep into his soul. I can see that you care for nothing. You love no one but yourself. Why should I? The boy answers arrogantly. She shakes her head. Then you are no better than a beast. The wise woman raises her arm. She glows with power and magic. The boy gasps. His eyes go wide and he bolts back into the castle. He flees past the regents who apologize to the wise woman on his behalf. Forgive him. He's just a child. It's like a child in need of the lesson, she answers. Please, please, we can't let you harm her. And I warn you not to interfere. Heedless of her warning, the regents block her way. She waves an arm at them, and they are transformed into objects, a mantel clock and a candelabra. She continues after the fleeing boy, transforming any and all who get in her way. The frightened boy runs through the castle. Looking over his shoulder, he dashes into the safety of his own room, shoving furniture in front of the door and hiding in a corner. Moments later, the wise woman appears in front of him. He cowers behind a chair. Since you are no better than a beast, then you deserve to look like one. She waves her arm, and the boy is transformed into a monstrous creature, half boy, half beast. She takes a single rose from her basket. It begins to glow with enchantment. This rose will bloom until your 21st birthday. If you can learn to love another and earn their love in return by the time the rose withers, then the spell will be broken. If not, you are doomed to remain a beast forever. She places the enchanted rose in an empty vase on the table. I will leave you with that and a gift. She reaches into the basket again and emerges with an ornate golden mirror. She places it on the table next to the rose. This enchanted mirror will show you any part of the wide world you wish to see. Look well, for it's a world you can no longer be a part of. and in a flash of mystical light, the old wise woman is gone. The Beast Child races desperately to the castle, up to the highest tower. He looks down to see her disappear in a deep, enchanted mist that is now surrounding the castle. "I'm sorry," he cries. Please come back. I'm sorry." And as the Beast Child peers desperately out through the bars, we pull back to, and that's where Belle steps out of her cottage.
Wow. Cool. That's really insightful, actually, yeah. And it does answer a couple of questions.
So it's been a long time since I've seen the animated version. Did we know where the mirror came from before?
No.
Okay, I didn't think we did, but I didn't want to like
he just
put that out
has
there.
It. Yeah. Yeah, that's one question, and then the other one is that most people have asked is why on earth did the Enchantress turn all the servants who were just doing their job into inanimate objects? And Jim just answered it. Anyone who got in her way was turned into an object.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, Jim. I'm glad you found that because that does actually make a lot of sense. And again, the child being kind of a petulant little brat, you know, it's not just like he was a good kid, but it was like, my parents told me never to answer the door. Like, he obviously was just kind of a jerk.
Yeah, they definitely like doubled down on him being a
peacock. Yeah.
Well, what's so funny is it was actually supposedly Kirk Weiss, Gary Trouzo and Kirk Weiss, who wound up directing the movie, who, you know, sort of confronted Howard Ashman about, you know, well, first of all, if it's a little kid being changed into a monster, isn't he going to end up looking like Eddie Munster? You know, I mean, it's just sort of like, you know, half beast, half monster. So it's just sort of like, you know, and more to the point, isn't it kind of a cheap way to get an audience's sympathy to hurt a child? And evidently, Ashman really did, you know, I mean, it was very invested in this opening of the movie and was very pissed off at the guys after they did that. But in the end, it had to go because, again, they just ran out of time and ran out of money. I mean, you know.
Well, Jim, I'm sure you know, they worked on this movie for like 6 months and scrapped everything because they completely changed the look of this movie. So, I mean, think of all that time of having all your animators and your creatives for 6 months work on a movie and all your art concept, and they just threw it out.
Well, I've talked with Don Hahn, the producer of the movie, a number of times, and he said, look, they kept the release date locked. You know, it was always November, Thanksgiving, 1991. And so by the time they fixed the story and got this thing turned around, they had 11 months to animate it. And as a direct result, I mean, you know, there's the famous cheat at the end where you finally get to see, you know, the Beast and Belle dance together and, you know, that's the repurposed animation from Prince Philip and Princess Aurora dancing at the end of Sleeping Beauty. In fact, you know, at the very beginning of the film, because, again, they had no time, they had no money, and they figured, you know, we can't just have pictures of stained glass windows, so they do the tracking shot in and on the castle, and, you know, they show you forest creatures. That's Bambi and his mom. You know, just sort of like, get him in there. Just
that's funny.
Know,
interesting.
Whatever convinces people this is an animated movie, go, you know.
Well, I think that's, again, really interesting the way that they did that with the intro. And I like the stained glass version better, honestly. And, I mean, I know that it leaves a couple of questions, but I like them kind of quickly getting through the intro about the prince. And
don't get me wrong. I think that that version's, you know, ridiculously effective.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is fun to read and you know, sure. But at the same time, that's 5 minutes of animation easy.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
And you know, it's just, so.
I think it answers questions, but it also kind of would have changed my opinion about the prince. And I think I don't want to know about his backstory. I don't want to know that he's a brat. I don't want to know if he's good or bad. You know, I kind of like to learn who the Beast is through the story and the songs and everything.
Which, though, in this movie, did you buy, again, we are what, two-thirds into the movie and we suddenly get, you know, the objects telling us, you know, the Beast, you know, backstory. Well, he's mean because his mother died and his dad was a tyrant. And it's like, you know, really? You know, it's like, you know, so this is the Strasburg version. You know, well, he has to have a motive for being a prick. So, you know,
I liked getting the backstory just because, I mean, it was better than not having one because, again, I mean, in that intro, you had your reasoning that he was just kind of a brat growing up as a kid, and that's how he was treated as royalty. And in this version, we have that his mother was kind, but the dad was a jerk. And, I mean, I can kind of get that, though. I mean, if you're raised by your dad and your dad's a... how are you going to grow up, you know?
I guess, don't get me wrong. I honestly think this is, in fact, I credit Nancy. This is Nancy's review of the live action Beauty and the Beast was like, this is 90% of a great movie. And then it's like 10% of what the fuck, you know, just sort of,
I think that's where I landed too, where it's like so much of the new stuff just, it just didn't resonate with me. And I don't say that as like a purist, like how dare you touch it.
Sure.
I think it's funny that they're making all these live action movies. Cause I remember after maybe A Bug's Life came out, after it became pretty clear that computer animation was going to make the hand-drawn stuff seem really antiquated, I remember saying to people then, if Disney was smart, what they would do is they would grab the soundtrack, the audio tracks from those old movies, and completely create new computerized animation and just drop in the old audio track. So can you imagine seeing Peter Pan but computer animated, like a Pixar movie? And like, you wouldn't have to change a thing from a storytelling set, you just need to reanimate it.
Yeah,
you know? Oh, that is so scary that you say that, because you are literally in the Venn diagram as to why they make these movies. I mean, that there's, I've heard folks at the studio basically say this is the equivalent of dealing with kids in the 1980s who wouldn't watch black and white movies, so that's why the studios colorized them.
Yeah.
You know, it turns out, according to Disney's market survey, that there's a whole generation of kids who love CG films, love the Pixar films, love Blue Sky, you know, what Illumination does. And when they look at these, you know, they everything from, you know, Snow White right up until, like, you know, Home on the Range, it's like, well, they all must have been made in the 1940s because they look old.
To me, because, you know, Jim, I honestly just got used to CG. Like, growing up as a kid of the 90s, growing up with all these great animated films, again, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast. I mean, Little Mermaid was the first movie I ever saw in theaters. So I grew up with these animated films, and they're so beautiful, and seeing them remastered and upscaled in Blu-ray.
To show you the difference in age between Kevin and I, the first movie I saw in the theaters was The Apple Dumpling Gang. So
okay, I could top all of you guys. You know, just again, first film I saw in theaters,
City Lights.
Okay, again, as a kid, Sword in the Stone. All right, 63.
Nice.
Okay?
Wow.
And you know, again, you know, the weird thing is you all of us have, you know, weird affection for that first film we saw, because again, you know, the whole going to the theater, it gets dark,
absolutely,
you're with all these people and giant screen and get to see this sort of thing. But the other thing that drives these choices, and remember, you know, that I'm sure you guys have seen just over the past couple of weeks, you know, the announcements of the, you know, Favreau's, you know, they much like the Jungle Book, the Lion King, he's starting to get off the ground, and he's doing things where it's like he's got Donald Glover doing the voice of adult Simba, which, like, okay, good, smart choice, I can get that. But then did you see who he got for Mufasa?
James Earl Jones. He's like,
yeah, April Welch. Sort of like, yeah. So the very thing you were saying about just take the, you know, the hand drawn and do it live, you know, do it with CG. It's like,
maybe I need to get my resume together.
But you know what? I mean, the thing is, though, and obviously he'll be revoicing it. They won't just use the audio. But if you have James Earl Jones alive, I mean, you can't replace that voice. They use him as Vader, even though the voice, you know, like, you cannot, long as James Earl Jones is around.
I can't imagine.
Sorry, I have to interrupt here because Dave Filoni told me this great story when they finally, you know, they're doing season 2 of Star Wars Rebels. And so that actually starts off with Darth Vader. And so they, you know, again, as part of the Lucasfilm acquisition, they got, you know, they're getting the band back together. So they reach out to James Earl Jones and, you know, would you do Vader? And it's like, yeah, sure. And so he's in the studio with James Earl Jones, and Jones is doing Vader for the first time in, he said, I think the last time I did this was 13 years ago. And, you know, so he's in the booth talking like James Earl Jones, and kind of underconfident about doing Vader again. It's like, you'll walk me through this, right? You're gonna you'll tell me how to do this again. And Filoni's something, you're doing it. I mean,
there's really no difference. Like, yeah, I mean, his voice
But I just love the whole notion of, you know, you're gonna have to direct me here. I forget how to do the character. It's like, just talk. You know, just talk.
Who would you get with a voice like that? Like, my first thought is,
Liam Neeson, but you can't have Liam Neeson voice Mufasa. He was already Aslan.
Yeah.
Very you know? True. It's like
that would be weird.
Who's our go-to list for lion characters? You know,
yeah, like who's got a voice with gravitas like that? Like, I honestly can't think of anybody off the top of my head. Do you know, we were talking about Aladdin earlier, do you have any idea who they're looking at for the genie?
You know, that's the thing. All that Guy Ritchie is willing to talk about right now is that, you know, he's definitely looking to cast. He wants it to look authentic to the world. In fact, it's interesting that both the Mulan live action that's being prepped, same thing. It's like, you know, Sarah, you've heard that there was a script initially out there where she had, you know, they were going to give her an Anglo love interest this time around. And, you know, somebody with a brain at Disney is like,
yeah.
They will eat us alive. Don't do that. So the genie right now, it's just a question of, well, the Aladdin Broadway musical is proven. You know, this character can move on past Williams, but at the same time, it's just sort of like the genie enters about a third of the way through the movie, and then he's the engine that drives the thing, both with the humor as well as the kind of the pathos of, you know, the whole, you know, again, you know, that's why everyone loves that moment where Aladdin throws away his third wish and frees the genie. I mean, that's a great moment.
I'll have to stop you there, because technically the genie shows up in the very beginning of the movie, because confirmed that he is the narrator.
Well, but again,
perceptually he did not. Yeah. You know, although in the Broadway play, he shows up as the genie at the beginning. Yep. I think because they know that the kids that go to see that and the parents have paid an ungodly amount of money to take their kids to see a Broadway play, those kids are going to be like, where the hell's the genie?
Right.
You know, we were talking one episode, two episodes ago, and we got on the topic of who would play the genie. And my suggestion, because you need a comedian that's very manic and can riff and come up with stuff off the top of his head and capture that energy, but you don't want somebody who's just going to be an impersonation of Robin Williams. You know what I mean? And I thought Kevin Hart would be a great choice, because he has that motor mouth thing going, and it would be such a different direction that it would be almost impossible to draw a comparison to Robin Williams, you know?
You know, that's actually a pretty inspired choice. And more to the point, he could play, he could do good again, because there's a melancholy to the genie that has to be there, that that's a great, you know, well, I hope somebody at Disney listens to that, because that's a great idea.
And it would open up the film to a whole new demo too. Not that black people don't like Disney movies, but it would be an invitation of like, this isn't just a Lily White thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And but again, you have to assume, if you look at, you know, what Guy Ritchie did with the, you know, the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock movies, this wasn't going to be a traditional Aladdin anyway. In fact, that's. You know, that he Richie was talking about, that, you know, he's done film about con men, about street rats. So it's like, okay, sure. I know this character. I can make this story work from that angle.
And I will say, like, it's funny you say that he's got that on his resume, because I think that ultimately, and we've talked about this in the podcast as well, has been the true genius of what Marvel has done with their Marvel movies, is that they found directors. They realize that each property within the Marvel Cinematic Universe is its own genre film. And so they've gone out, and with Iron Man, it's like, you got this main character who's kind of a bagog, but you like him anyway, and he's got this patter that's nonstop. Let's get the guy who made Swingers. Thor is kind of this fake Shakespearean thing. Let's get Kenneth Branagh. Like, each movie, they've kind of gone out and found the guy that already knows how to make that genre of film and said, just make it like that, you know? And so to get to realize that Aladdin is about a con man, essentially, and street rats, and to find a guy that knows how to make those movies is a very, very smart choice.
Oh, I agree. You know, in fact, it's kind of ironic we're having this conversation right now, because in 2007 was, remember, Marvel made this announcement that you know, they were going to make 10 movies, you know, and that they were all going to be interconnected. And, you know, they were, you know, for the first time ever, they were going to own the movies. And everybody laughed because it was like, oh, come on, you're Marvel. You can't possibly, you know, you're the guys who signed away the rights for Spider-Man and the X-Men. You know, in fact, I was just reading a story where Maisel, the executive who came in and set this whole thing up, as he's walking in the door to pitch them on this whole idea, you know, they're in the process of signing off the film rights to Captain America and Thor, and he's like, no, we're going to need those, you know, just you can't do that.
And, saved by the bell.
And I just remember back there, it's like, you're Marvel, you're going to hopelessly screw this up, and look at where we are now. I mean, you know,
well, and I think everybody's
chasing that model.
Well, and I think what they did right, and where the other people are making a mistake in chasing that model, is they want to hop on four movies in, you know, and they don't realize the degree of patience that Marvel had, that they built it right and they didn't go straight to we need to put out four movies a year, and it needs to be this huge they gave you Iron Man, and then you waited, and you got the next one, and DC, they can't finish the movie they're on. Every movie is about setting up the next three movies, and nobody cares about the next three movies because the one that you're watching sucks.
I still remember when they announced they were casting Robert Downey Jr., and everyone was like, what? And then at the same time, remember for the first time you saw that movie and the wonderful way it ended with the press conference, and
yes,
it's like, yeah, I'm Iron Man. And it's just sort of like, I have never, you know, for those of us who've seen dozens upon dozens of superhero movies, I've never seen this movie before, you know, and it's just sort of like, I can't wait for the next one of these. I mean, it's, you know, that's the feeling you want coming out of a movie. It's just sort of like, no, more story, more. And again, what was great about that, to then get that tag scene at the end with Samuel Jackson, that is just sort of like, holy crap, there's more coming.
To find a way to get people to stay through the credits now in every single movie.
Looking for that, expecting it.
My kids never want to sit through the credits, or never want to not. They never want to leave during the credits on any movie I take them to. It's like they know all the gaffers by name. It's crazy.
I have to tell you, by the way, do you guys ever go out to CinemaCon at Vegas? Or
we don't got that kind of money. They don't fly us anywhere.
You have to go at some point. You have to go, because it's just sort of like when you were talking about movies with guys who run theaters. In fact, for example, exhibitors hate the tag scene, because again,
they can't clean the theater.
No, that's exactly. They get the 16-year-old with the trash barrel, and they, you know, the room is waiting. You know,
I was still sitting there. I was at a screening the other day, and the screening was running late. It was like a promotional screening, and they were like, "We have to wait for this movie to end." Mm-hmm. And they were like, "Well, can you just kill the credits?" And they were like, "No, we can't kill the credits because the movie was Kong Skull Island," and they were like, "We can't kill the credits because there's a post credit scene, and if we do, they're all going to want refunds. They're all sitting there waiting for the movie to end so they can see the final scene."
Godzilla and Ghidra, and you know,
yeah,
again, I know we are in tangent hell here, guys.
It's what we do. It's what we do. So let's jump back into the movie proper.
So I mean, basically,
she kisses him the end.
Yeah, right. No? we don't have to go beat for beat for beat, but I think we should kind of just group things into here. So Emma Watson is Belle.
Yay, never heard of her.
Yay or nay?
She was fine. She didn't blow my mind, but I wasn't like, this is awful either. You know, she did an admirable, serviceable. Like,
I thought the look was fine. I thought her voice was good. It's just really, really hard to match Paige O'Hara because she is so good. Her vocal range. If you go back and you listen to Belle, Paige O'Hara, and you listen to Emma Watson, there's no comparison. Like Emma Watson, and I'm not trying to diss on Emma Watson. I mean, she did a great job preparing for the role and practicing and everything, but her voice just isn't. It's just not as good as Paige O'Hara's. And so, you know, the fan in me was just always comparing. And again, I like these versions, but when you compare, it's just a really tough thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, you know, she was brought into this project by Alan Horn. You know, that's the president of Warner Brothers during the whole time the Harry Potter movies were being made. In fact, he was the one who kept her on the series. Emma wanted to bail as they were coming up to Goblet of Fire, and it just sort of like... And he was like, no, you don't understand. This is going to be this series of 7 or 8 films that you know, nobody's ever done this before, and you really want to be part of this. And
wow.
If you talk with the folks at Disney Studios, they know from their own research that third up to a half of the audience turned out because it was Emma Watson. Because,
oh my
in fact,
gosh,
this
yeah.
is one of the reasons they chased her for Cinderella. They wanted her to get her to play the title role in that. And she, you know, it just, you know, at that point, they, again, same thing like the Mulan script. They had, they'd written this different character for her to fall in love with, a sort of a dissolute knight rather than the prince. And she was like, nah. But Alan came after her, pursued her for Beauty and the Beast. And she was like, as soon as he said the title, it's like, I'm in. It's my favorite film. I grew up on that movie. You know, I'm in. Shut up.
Wow. So, I mean, it's great casting. I mean, she pulls off the look of Belle. She pulls off the character, and her voice really is good. So I don't mean to, you know, underplay how good she is. You know, it's just hard to compare. But then for the marketing side, like you just mentioned, the fact that half of the box office, half of the $500 million that's made in under 2 weeks is because she's Hermione. You know, it's genius.
What did you think of her being the inventor, the whole making the washing, you know, she invents the washing machine so she can teach the other girl to read, and then that somehow upsets the entire village because, you know, oh my God, she's teaching girls to read.
I mean, obviously this is the 1700s, so it's a different time, but in real life, you know, this is 2017. So I get it. I get what they're trying to do. I think they handled it pretty well. Like, it didn't, since I know what they were trying to do, I know that it's a bit forced, but I think they handled it well enough where it really didn't come off leaving a bad taste in my mouth. But, you know, in 2017, you can't have just a pretty face. You can't have Belle meaning beauty. You can't just have a pretty girl that reads books but also needs to be saved and rescued all the time. So she's an inventor. She's tough. She can stand up to Gaston. She doesn't say, oh, you know, I'll see you next week. I'm busy, Gaston. She says, I'm not going to marry you, and slams the door in his face. You know, that's just women, you know, today. And I think that's the role model that young girls need to see in 2017, not the 25-year-old version.
Okay.
Yeah, I would make the argument that I think Belle was never just a pretty face. I think that's why there was, you know, I mean, she was hyper literate. You know what I mean? And so,
sure.
I mean, I kind of felt like, you know, it didn't ruin the movie for me or anything, but I just felt like it's at some point it starts to feel like pandering.
I get knowing what they're going for, that's the only reason why it came off a bit forced, but I think it was handled well. And in the original, yeah, the reading was really the only thing, but it's like, you can't just show girls that, hey, you know, because you can read and you're smarter than people, like, they want to show you above and beyond. You can fight and you can invent things and you can be, you know, smarter than the guys in all these regards. And so, you know, I just think it was a necessary choice to upgrade the character. It was necessary.
Sure. I do wonder at some point if, like, we have an overcorrection on our hand. Like, every movie goes to this point to where it's like, is this generation of boys going to grow up and be like, well, boys suck? Like, and women
it's
do
everything. Oh, God, it's so funny you say this, because it's like, if you understand Disney history, the reason Belle is the way she is because of Ariel. I mean, think about it. When Little Mermaid comes out in 89, you have this 16-year-old girl who meets a guy, and, you know, and literally, you know, from the second she meets a guy, she's willing to turn her back on her family, leave her dad, you know, and you know, put it all behind her because, you know, she's fallen in love with this handsome guy. So that was actually the complaint from the feminist community, you know, just effective. That's a really bad lesson to give girls. So if you look at Belle, it's like she's ridiculously loyal to her father. Or, you know, like, you know, in fact, she offers to trade places with him at the castle. And you know, she's fallen in love with the Beast, but sees he's sick in the mirror, and I must go to him. So, you know, she's family first. And at the same time, because the whole notion of Ariel doesn't seem to have any skills, it's all right, Belle's got to read, Belle's got to, you know. But then the weird thing is, coming out of the 91 animated Beast, is that people were complaining about, oh my God, if you look back at it, it's like Belle is staying in an abusive relationship. I mean, the Beast is so terrible to her.
Stockholm syndrome.
You know, and so
that's what people cry. Exactly, you know, yeah. And it's a Stockholm syndrome story, yeah. And how what kind of a lesson is that? And so they do make her so much stronger in this version, where that isn't really a question anymore.
That's absolutely, and in fact, but the funny thing is, you jump ahead to Aladdin. So it's now when a guy, you have Aladdin when he lies to a girl, you see that he agonizes over about it. He feels bad. You know, just sort of, you know, it's like each, you know, that's the funny thing is if you look at each of those movies, each of them is trying to correct the complaints about the movie that came previously. So,
and I think sometimes I feel bad for filmmakers in that
they're rich and famous.
Well, there's that. And then
poor guys.
But then like every character somehow is supposed to be all things to all people, or yeah. It rep, you know, like,
oh, today it'd be an impossible task to be a filmmaker in like, 2017.
You know, I mean, if the box we're painting filmmakers into is that every character has to be brilliant and smart and always make wonderful decisions, or it's a poor reflection on whatever category or label they might get lumped into or assigned,
or like, not, or then, whatever label they
yeah,
aren't,
then how do you like, you yeah. know, like I do think they kind of had a redemption story arc for LeFou, because they feel like if he's gay that we can't do that, and it's like, but at some point, why can't you? Like, well, I get if we lived in a world where there were almost no gay characters, and then you make a gay character and he's a villain, like, you're like, whoa, well, I don't think that should be your only representation. But as we get further and further away from that point, it's kind of like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? And Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, that was a very controversial choice in that time. So they took Sidney Poitier and they made his character like over the top. Perfect. Like, it was like he was a doctor and he worked in Africa and he helped dying kids who were born with flippers for hands. Like, everything had yeah. to be like he is just the ultimate example of human goodness. And it's like, but that also is like, you're also giving those actors like really boring roles to play. And then you're like, why don't they get awards? And it's like, because they have awful roles to play.
Mm. Yeah.
The Got other it. Thing, just a quick note here about LeFou, that according to Condon, and again, you know, that as they were shaping the screenplay here, the thinking was that LeFou was going to be the contemporary voice in the film. I mean, but by both raising his IQ and having him somewhat outside the story, kind of observing this and being in the middle of this change, that he was going to be in a lot of ways, you know, sort of the voice in the audience. And again, it, you know, as you pointed out, that line in Kill the Beast, you know, where he you're seeing him turn, you're seeing him think.
Right.
But again, look, I enjoy Josh Gad, and for me, it worked. I know for a lot of people, you know, just because of what was said, we're constantly going to the movies. Is that the especially gay moment? No, hang on. Or is that
right?
The that's you know, the you bring up yeah. a good point, and that is exactly the issue. Is that if they were going to do it, they should have doubled down. They yeah. were too afraid to double down and make him openly gay. So what they tried to do is they tiptoed around it and made a character that's kind of maybe offensively flamboyant,
yeah,
and questionably, is he gay, is he not gay? And then at the end he dances with the guy for 2 seconds. It's like, if you're gonna make an openly gay character, embrace it and make it right. What's the controversy for?
Yeah, no, I agree. I said it when we talked about it on a past episode. I thought that his I thought it was just as offensive to gay people because he's so prancy. He's like kind of every gay stereotype, that it's like, it's weird that they're making this big deal about they have, you know, an officially gay character in this Disney movie, and really the most concrete thing, I'm making air quotes over concrete, right, the most concrete thing to point to is as proof that he's gay is like, well, look how he talks, you know, like,
right, that's why I don't think he's not an openly gay character, because there's nothing open about it other than what you infer, which may be correct, but you're still inferring it.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I have seriously flawed gaydar then, because I just got the sense that they actually bent the needle in the other direction, that it just sort of the gayness of the character is the, I mean, he's clearly enamored of Gaston, but it's just sort of, again, it's undercooked. It's, you know, the whole thing of him hugging him a little too long after the song. People tell me I'm clingy. You know, so, I mean, yeah. I think a lot of that just comes from the, you know, the kind of performer Josh Gad is. That, you know, remember that you know, this is the Book of Mormon guy who, would form weird attachments to his fellow brothers and again, out in Africa. So
I think he did a great job with the role. The thing is, he put his own spin on it, but the character was still written to say certain things and do certain things. Yeah. And it's not Josh Gad's fault. I think he's a great actor. I think he's hilarious. But I just think that they wrote the character wrong.
He was kind of like early season Smithers.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it is the exact same relationship as
Smithers and Tonto. Mm. How they've kind of updated Tonto to where like Tonto is the brains and the Lone Ranger is the dumb one. Gaston was always the dumb one, but he was dumber.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and it's funny, I mean, LeFou literally translates into the fool. So to make him smart just for the sake of doing it, that does kind of go against the character.
Maybe it's ironic the way they always call big guys tiny.
There you go.
I don't know. I mean, again, this is probably admitting that I was dropped as a child on my head too many times, but I really kind of liked Lone Ranger, you know, just sort of the kind of left-handedness of it. And remember, that was, you know, originally supposed to be the sort of the twin of Pirates of the Caribbean. And, you know, I've actually got a copy of the script where the Butch Cavendish, you know, the whole thing where he eats the heart and that sort of thing that's because he's a werewolf. And that's
different. Okay.
That's actually why.
I would explain the silver bullet, I guess.
The first script for the Lone Ranger. The reason that the Lone Ranger uses silver bullets is because he's not just killing bad men, he's killing bad men who are werewolves.
Oh my gosh. That might have actually been a better movie.
And I will say, I think the Lone Ranger was a misfire, but I didn't think it was as bad as it got made out to be.
Not at all.
Yeah. I remember that.
I remember everybody in the room looking at me like I was crazy because they thought I was going to hate it. And I was like, it was fine. They just needed it. It just didn't quite work, but it wasn't horrendous. I've actually got a friend
who's a big time Disney collector. I mean, as in, he's one of these guys who buys, you know, has the basement filled with toys that are still in their boxes that, you know, he just bought them for trading further on down the line. And he remains totally convinced that the Lone Ranger is the next Rocketeer, that, you know, 15, 20 years down the line, this is going to be playing on television or our phones or whatever it is we're watching at that point, and people are going to rediscover it and love it. And that's why when everything was marked down to 10 cents on the dollar, he cleaned out every Disney store.
I was going to say, the Disney store, you could have cleaned up in that 90% off
worth of stuff. And it's all in his basement, all, you know, sealed in plastic, waiting for that moment when, you know, people want to have Disney Lone Ranger stuff. So
see, I think the movie that will be like that, and there weren't that many toys made for it, was Real Steel.
Oh.
See, that was a fun movie. I like that in the same kind of way that I like Pacific Rim. I know you don't like Pacific Rim as much, but it's one of those it's giant robots punching each other. It's fun. And
it was such a good story, though, on top of it.
But it was good, and Hugh Jackman's great. Yeah. I mean, that movie is I think that's one of the big issues that we're having when critics are overly critical of films and not judging them based on what they're trying to achieve. You know, not every movie is Citizen Kane, and I'm not saying you shouldn't make the best version of whatever you're setting out to do, but sometimes they do a really good version and people compare it to something else that is
I'm a big believer that you have to judge a movie on what it's attempting to be. Animal House is a great movie, but no, it's not Citizen Kane. It's a great Animal House,
right?
So let's jump back into Beauty and the Beast.
So Luke Evans is Gaston. I will have to say that he is probably my favorite part of this movie. I think Luke Evans did this character so much justice and may even top the animated version. I really loved his performance. I thought he could sing, but I also thought he could act. And being the chauvinist and just loving himself and looking in the mirror, I thought he really pulled it off. And again, I mean, these are characters that I've grown up watching. And so Gaston's is big shoes to fill, and the voice and you know, that whole personality. And man, I was really, really impressed with Luke Evans.
I don't know. I'm a big Robbie Benson fan.
Wasn't he the Beast?
Yeah. Isn't that what you said?
Gaston.
Oh, I thought you said the Beast. I'm sorry.
No.
Sorry. Okay, then that case, I do agree with you.
Yeah, I think Luke Evans was awesome. I was like, wow, because he's a larger-than-life character. And especially when you cast someone who, I mean, sure, Luke Evans may be ripped, but he's not as big as Gaston in the cartoon. That's a huge guy. So when you get someone that's just an average-looking but, you know, really in good shape guy, you're like, okay, he doesn't quite have the height or the build. You know, he's got to have the voice and he's got to have the personality. And man, he sells it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that he really threaded the needle in terms of like capturing the spirit of the cartoon without becoming a character.
Yeah.
Like I thought he of the four main characters, I think that he was probably the best.
Yeah, and he never comes off as silly, because that's what we would do. If you try to be the big, bulky, you know, Gaston from the cartoon, you're going to come off as just a really, really terrible, cheesy actor, yes. Right? And he didn't, and that was what was so great about it.
Yeah, it would be too over the top to see a real live human do that.
It would. What did you guys think about, okay, the songs? So the songs, again, we've talked about it. I mean, they've got a built-in Broadway musical from the moment it was released in 91. Beautiful songs by Ashman and Menken. These songs, obviously, they've updated. They've changed the arrangements a little bit, the way they sing them. How do you guys think they compared the original numbers?
I mean, I would say that I like the original songs better, but I wasn't disappointed with these renditions. They were, for the most part, fairly faithful. I don't think the average person outside of just a diehard fan that is intimately familiar with the soundtrack of the original, I don't think the average person is going to notice any major differences between them. You know, it's not like all of a sudden, you know, Be Our Guest was reggae. You know
yeah,
I mean? Like,
right.
It was,
they were fairly faithful.
They were pretty straightforward.
I was happy with them. I mean, again, I think I just love the original too much, and not saying that just because of nostalgia. I mean, I think the original is so good, right?
Yeah.
You know, I thought they were definitely, I did a good job. Jim, what about you?
Well, my problem is that, you know, when Days in the Sun, the new song for, you know, when the creatures, you know, or the enchanted objects are going to bed, it's like, my problem is my yardstick is human again, which is, you know, both in the Broadway show and in the enhanced version of Beauty and the Beast was created for the IMAX release. So that's a killer number. And Days in the Sun, I just don't think compares to it. And I guess I have to grade that one on a curve. In fact, I think the thing that kind of makes me a little nuts about this is, did you hear that originally Disney wanted to do this without music? I mean, literally, it was going to be Beauty and the Beast. That was going to be what was going to make it different from the animated film is no songs. And Condon was like, are you people insane?
Oh, that would have killed it. I mean, that would.
It's not a strong enough story. Oh. It's just, although I will say, I would have thought that about Cinderella, mm-hmm. and Cinderella with almost no songs.
Because Cinderella doesn't have, aside from Bippity Boppity
right.
Boo, you know what I mean? Like, Cinderella is not Beauty and the Beast.
Sure.
Aladdin, like Lion King. I mean, you have to have those songs.
Yeah, like even Jungle Book worked in kind of the one song that mattered, you know. But yeah, that would have been awful. Now, I've never seen the original. I was too lazy to look this up. Did they, or not the original, the Broadway play, did they use any of the songs that they, because there's
no,
new songs in the Broadway production,
in fact,
right?
That's, yeah. You know, that's, look, Eisner was the one who actually first talked about doing a movie version of, you know, a live action movie version of Beauty and the Beast. In fact, I forget which of the, I mean, it might be the first time the film came out on Blu-ray, you know. I mean, you know how Disney, every 5 years, it's like, this is the platinum edition. This is the diamond edition. This is the turquoise ring, you know, flannel edition.
Oh, I haven't gotten my turquoise flannel ring yet.
There you go.
I got to get that one.
But at the end of, you know, one of the making of features, you know, that here's Eisner. And it's like, you know what we should do? We should do this as a live action movie and take the best of the songs from the Broadway show and the songs that people love from the movie and do this. And it's like, boy, I really want us to do this someday. And it's sort of like, so if Eisner had been in charge and this had actually gone forward, and evidently the plan was they were going to wait for the show to finish its Broadway run, never anticipating that it would run on Broadway for 13 years.
Right, that it would never end.
You know, so in fact, they shut it down so they could move Little Mermaid into the Lunt-Fontaine. You know, I want to say that's 2006, 2007.
Why would they not use those songs, though? Like, if they're already out there, they already know that they work and people like them, why would they not import them?
I don't get it, other than to just add something new. But
no, this is – I hate to say this, but this is the world of Hollywood. And it's like, look, if you put three new songs into the score, chances are one of them will get nominated for an Academy Award.
And I get that. I would think that they would do what Dreamgirls did. They would write their one new song. They would pull in two songs from Broadway that they know already work. And then, you know what I mean? And then that way, if you have, you know, that way you don't have to worry about having three clunkers. Like, you already know you got stuff that's been road tested.
There must have, you know, but I think the problem is, Tom, that the original movie, and even though it only runs an hour and a half, has so many good songs that if you're going to do like a mashup, I mean, you can't have them all because it'd be too long, but what do you cut? Because the songs are so good, and it is song after song after song. And so I think if they wanted new stuff in, they can't get rid of the old stuff. I mean, I'm not saying they couldn't have worked in but
I just think instead of three new songs,
four.
Like, it was a four? Okay, cut it down to one and bring in three from, or even two and two. Like, Chuck Woolery it.
I think what Jim said is, I think he's on the money, though, that they wanted four new songs for four attempts at best song. Because the new ones, I liked Evermore. I know I'm alone here, but like, I thought that song was beautiful. The other three, I could never hear again.
I would say write your four, pick your best one, and then go with what works. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, you want to win those awards ultimately to drive box office, and you're not going to have an issue here. You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
Nobody's going to run out and buy Beauty and the Beast just because it got nominated for an Oscar for best song.
No.
Like, it's going to make all the money no matter what you do, unless you just completely screw the pooch.
So basically, I mean, just going
through, might be bad wording considering what this movie's about.
Yeah. Oh, no. So
in fact, you know, just to circle back to the gay LeFou thing, I think it was Don Hahn who was out. It's like, now let me get this straight. You know, people are upset about, you know, a gay LeFou, when basically this is a movie that celebrates bestiality. You know, it's
right?
Like, he wants to sleep with a buffalo. All right,
now,
and you're worried about the gay supporting villain character. It's like,
Well, I think that's the kind of double standard or the hypocrisy that we face with most people that take issues with things like that. It makes no sense. But I will say, ultimately, the reason that I think, going back to what Tom said about making the film CG instead of live action, that is where this movie probably would have been a little stronger. Again, maybe weaker, because you're not seeing people like Emma Watson that are a huge draw. But the difference is that when you have a woman falling in love with a creature in live action, that's a little weird. I mean, I'm just throwing that out there. It's a little off-putting.
But they always also make sure that he reverts to a human before they really move too terribly far into the...
But she still fell in love with the creature. And what I'm saying is that in cartoon form, right, that we all grew up with, I mean, that we've known and loved since 91, it's a cartoon, right? So people are more accepting of it.
Yeah,
when you come to live action, that's always the struggle. Because, I mean, the Beast looked okay. I thought the animation was decent, but you're still
I thought he was kind of jerky in spot, not as a character, but I thought that he was very kind of spasmatic at times. Like,
I think it was good, but it wasn't great, and that's the struggle you're going to have with a live action film and a beast monster guy. You know what I mean? How are you going to get that right?
I also think it's ironic that they take these animated films and they say, let's make a live action version of it, and then like 80% of it is CG, which is really just animation.
Yeah. Well, you know, was just, it? Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. To give Dan Stephen some credit, the story is coming off of the set in Shepperton. Is this poor slob is wearing 8-inch long stilts in a performance capture outfit. You know, he has to show up every day to get all those markers put on his face. And there's this great story about, you know, so he and Emma shoot the ballroom scene. And then, you know, they later in production, they're like, Dan, I'm sorry, can you come in today? You know, we didn't get the face of the Beast the way we wanted to during the ballroom scene. And, you know, you're falling in love with her. So, you know, we're going to do that again. And he basically had to sit in a chair and move his head. You know, they showed him the live action, the reference footage of the Beast moving. And so he had to move his head as if he were waltzing while sitting in a chair, falling in love with, you know, again, just with a camera right at him. Emma's like 3 weeks off the film at this point, and it's just sort of like, I'm waltzing in a chair.
You know? Well, poor guy. I heard the story was he had to film the entire movie twice because it was his waist up and then the legs. I heard that so you had like his movement, his facial expressions, and then the lower half of his body were filmed two separate times.
Yikes.
So I mean, poor guy. It's nothing against him, you know. I'm just like that. That's awful to have to go through that and do the same performance twice and get that right. But I think it was good. I think his performance was good. I think his voice was good. I feel that it was kind of Robbie Benson inspired.
Sure.
I don't think it quite matches Robbie Benson. I mean, I definitely will say that the original is so good. But the first time you hear him when he's in the castle and the dungeon and Belle is trying to, you know, rescue her father, I heard his voice and I'm like, okay, like I can buy it. I didn't go, oh, I hate that voice because it was very inspired.
I would say ultimately, and again, overall, I like the movie, but I would say ultimately the movie is a really top-notch tribute band.
That's an excellent analogy. I can totally get behind that. One last thing, because I have to ask what you guys thought at this moment. All right, it's the end of Be Our Guest. All right, you know, we're building to the big number, and they suddenly cut to the Taj Mahal-like dish cabinet at the end of the table. And the door bursts open, and here's Cogsworth with the turban, and the air fills with colored explosions, like out of, you know, a Huli Spring Festival, the celebration of colors, celebration of spring. Tell me, I'm not the only one who thought you deliberately did that to go after the Indian market.
You know, that's an interesting thought. I wasn't thinking that. What I was going to say is Be Our Guest is my number one complaint about the film. And I loved the film. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very good. Obviously, I'm a fan of the original, but I've seen this movie twice. I want to see it again. Mm-hmm. But Be Our Guest was, again, too self-indulgent for me because... And these live action films, again, they're live action. We're not in a cartoon. We're in the real world here. And as much fantasy and magic as there is, they're still in a real world 1700s France. And so Be Our Guest goes from the dining table into CGIville. And you just like, where are we? When you're halfway through the song and you see all the spoons and the dishes doing their thing and they're stacked up higher than probably the castle is tall. I mean, I'm obviously just over exaggerating here, but my point is that we've taken this grounded film and we've taken this one of the best numbers of the movie, but we've traveled to CGIville off of the dining room table and out of the kitchen, and I didn't like where we ended up. I thought they just did it because they could and they wanted to be big and flashy about it, and I don't think it fit the tone.
It was like a Busby Berkeley scene. It was just like, and then it was also almost like, who was the lady did all the swimming stuff? Esther Williams.
Yeah.
Like it was almost at that point like watching a kaleidoscope.
That's what it was. Yeah. Exactly. I felt like I was watching a kaleidoscope, acid trip, something like they did in Doctor Strange with all the colors.
Kind of kaleidoscopes did your mother give you?
But I mean, it was a combination of just a crazy thing. And again, visually, like if I were to watch that on its own, I'd be like, yes, visually impressive. Good job, computer people.
Right.
But as for the film, I'm like, you're telling me we're in the dining room right now? No way. And it just, it was too out there for
me. At that point it was just completely surrealistic.
Yeah,
like there was just,
it made no sense to be this grounded world.
They were just doing it because they could.
If you talk with anybody associated with the film, they say they went that way, they buried the needle in that direction for the 3D version. You know, this was
all about
convincing the audience that they had to pay $15 a ticket to see this. And so
I will say I've seen a lot of 3D movies where I take off my glasses because I do that a lot because I don't like 3D. And the movie, in large swaths of the film, aren't really all that 3D. And I will say...
They're not blurry.
Yeah, every time I took off my glasses in this film, it was very blurry. Like, they obviously really did their 3D rendering on this. When they tell you that it's 3D, it's not three scenes, and then the rest of it is just like, make that rock look closer. Like, it was... They didn't Clash of the Titans it. Like,
sure.
They did it for real. Yeah. So, I gotta give them credit for that.
Yeah.
So.
But, I mean, really, the plot just pretty much stays the same. So, a couple of differences that I liked. I think I mentioned it earlier, but early on, when Belle is, you know, going through the town, and Gaston says, I'm gonna go ask her to be my wife, like, instead of doing the big party and the band that LeFou has in the cartoon, he just goes up to her door. But Emma Watson's Belle straight up tells Gaston, I'm never going to marry you, and shuts the door in his face. I liked it, you know? Yeah. It didn't go over the top like it could have if they tried to recreate the cartooniness. Sure. Also gave Belle that strength. Kevin Kline's Maurice, he's an artist instead of an inventor, I guess, mainly. I mean, he tinkers, but he's more of an artist.
Yeah.
And he leaves to go to town, and, you know, he has the wolf fight. I mean, it's basically the same thing as the cartoon. The horse comes back, Belle goes after him, and then, you know, trades places with him. Very much the same. You know, I thought the introduction, I thought the characters, like when we talk about the ancillary characters, like Cogsworth and Lumiere, you know, I thought they did a pretty good job. I thought Ian McKellen, I loved him as Cogsworth. I think he's great in the role. Ewan McGregor, you know, I mean, the English accent was touch and go, but he was good. He had the charisma. He had the character. What did you guys think? Those are kind of the two big side characters.
Yeah, I thought those were the closest to just flat out impersonations of the original film. But I think it works, especially since they're animated. It's less jarring to see someone basically impersonating what came before them.
Yeah.
I know we've been jumping around the whole time here, but what did you think of at the end where it was revealed like Cogsworth had a wife in the village, or for that matter, Mrs. Potts had a husband in the village, and the whole conceit of the part of the spell was that the village forgot, you know, that
it makes it make a lot more sense.
It really is, because how do you forget a castle and a prince and all that just because they're turned into beasts and inanimate objects? It's like, this is the prince of the town. I don't know what you call it, but, you know, this is the prince. How do you forget him? And I think the spell working on the villagers like that was very smart.
Okay. I guess for me that the Mrs. Potts, I mean, I kind of felt bad for Emma Thompson having to try to make that moment work, or for that matter, the actor. I mean, once you watch it, if you're seeing it for the second time, and the you know, Belle having that moment with him in the village, it's like, what have you forgotten? You know, you've forgotten something again? And it's like, this is Mr. Potts, who's clearly troubled by, you know, there's something I can't remember. Oh, yeah, my wife, my child.
Yeah, you know? Right there when you watch it again.
So, like, look, it's okay to change things. It just, that one felt kind of like, all right, and that was, again, a long way to go for the joke of, you know, turn me back into a clock, turn me back into the clock. I hate my life. Turn me back into the clock.
Yeah. That was kind of funny.
He literally wanted to turn back time.
Yeah, I mean, they're not too many huge changes. You know, again, I liked the going to Paris and going to the house, just because it gave the mother's backstory and what happened to her. Because in the cartoon, I always wondered, why is she alone with the dad?
Yeah.
And I mean, the attraction aside, I mean, again, I know the Belle's Storytime Cottage or whatever, but that didn't really bother me. I mean, I know that gives you questions, but again, I think for the story and to flesh out the characters and make them more complete, I liked that change. And other than that, there wasn't a whole lot of different. I liked the line that LeFou had again in Kill the Beast, because it gave him, it made it like he's not just a lackey that's going to follow him to his death. You know, it gave the character of LeFou more to do, and it made him more like, hey, okay, you know, I want to be like this guy. He's popular. Like, that's all great until you realize he's a bad dude. Like, he's not, this is not someone that I should just be blindly following into battle. And so I liked it, just that small little line change and the delivery by Josh Gad. I think that adds a lot to the character. So, like, subtle things like that they changed. They weren't like they changed, you know, 20 minutes or 30 minutes or 15 pages of story. Like, they made those subtle little changes, but to me it made the story more complete.
Yeah, I can get, though, actually, there's a fun little moment at the end, and I'm not talking about Josh dancing with the guy, but it turns out when they were putting this film together, somebody dug down into Howard Ashman's trunk and found one more verse to Beauty and the Beast. And that there's a line that we've never heard before of famine turns to feast. And what's funny is that back in 91, when, you know, they were looking at Peebo Bryson and Celine Dion to sing the song, there was pressure from the studio to the effect of, you know, we need one more verse. We think we have a top 10 hit here. And it's like, guys, I have used, the only word I have not used that rhymes with beast at this point is yeast. You know, and it's just, you know, I get this, you know, there's only so many words, you know, and it's like,
he was like, I can't do anything.
So
he was like, I can't do anything else. Sheesh. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
There you go.
That is so. That is funny. But, you know, so at the end, I will say the last thing that they really changed was the ending, mm-hmm. because it's a dramatic moment. So you have to remember in the cartoon, she says, I love you right before the beast dies. The petal falls and it's like a photo finish. You know, which one's going to happen? He turns back in. Yay. Happy day. In this movie, they kill everyone. Essentially, they turn into inanimate objects for a moment. And it's sad. It's like 4 minutes long.
Yeah. I thought they held that beat a little too long.
I have to admit, you know, I mean, in fact, you know, when they almost killed Chip, you know, it's like one of those things. Yeah. It's like, but I get it. I mean, you know, this, in fact, you know, that's the conceit of the Broadway show, is that as you're watching the thing on stage, the costumes change as time goes on. They become more and more like the objects that they are. And they do that a couple of times during the film. When a petal falls, they become that much more stiffer, or, you know, Cogsworth becomes even more clock-like. But I don't know. I get it. You know, I get the choice, and it actually did. I mean, you're right. It's too long, but it works.
I liked it too, Jim. I really liked it because, again, I've grown up with this movie. I've known it for 25 years. I know what's going to happen. And in the end, the same thing still happens. Yeah. But it was like, wait, what? Hold on. Like, it kept me guessing. And I liked that they added it. And it was a bit emotional. Like, even though I knew that they were going to be okay, I was like starting to tear up. I'm like, hey, they actually did do it pretty well, I think.
Really like candles. Well. He never lights them, you know, for that very reason.
I love the moment with Emma Thompson sliding on the tray with her son, the, you know, little boy turning back into little boy. I could have done without the dog peeing, you know, but it's just sort of like, I get it. You're looking
the coat
at the
racks. Yeah, it was funny, but, you know, and then in the end, it's like happily ever after. It's all good.
I saw it with the whole family. And I was sitting next to my son, who's 17, and so I was driving him crazy because every time they would show the coat rack, I'd be like, hey, check out that rack. I'm like, and he's like, Dad, I'm like, this joke never gets old. You're going to hear it for the whole movie because I'm the one that's a teenager. So, well, thank you for joining us, Jim. This has been a great discussion. It's always great to have you on. You have so much insight and backstory and things that happened a million years ago that you have squirreled away in your basement. You must have a very patient wife.
There's lots of squirrels in the basement.
Yeah.
Traps, but no, it's always a treat, guys.
Tell them where they can find you and all your wonderful Disney and other animation and theme park news.
Oh, let's see. We've got Jim Hill Media. I do the stuff for the Huffington Post. I do the podcast with Len Testa. That's at iTunes and Bandcamp. And like I said, I'm in the basement killing squirrels. So, you know, hey, it's a full life. So.
Well, thank you. And Kevin, why don't you tell them where they can find you?
Sure. This is Kevin Brackett. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett and read the reviews and interviews on ReviewSTL.com.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. Don't forget, if you want to continue the conversation online, if you have your thoughts about Beauty and the Beast, you can find us at Facebook.com/RealSpoilers, where you can leave a message or tell us how much we suck. I don't know. You can do all sorts of things there. You could also share an episode of the show with your friends. Join the League of Show Sharers. That's always delightful
as
well.
You know what? What they can always do is tell the fine folks how bad of a movie Monster Squad is.
Joe loves it when people do that. So feel free to stop by and do that as well. And also, don't forget, we're available on iTunes, so you can go there, rate, review, subscribe. We greatly appreciate it, and it helps us tremendously. So that's it for this episode. So thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Larry's father bludges him to death with his own walking stick.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.